Shane Murphy Goldsmith, President and CEO of Liberty Hill Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to a special episode of Conversations from the Frontlines. In this special best of episode, we're taking a look back at some exciting moments from season two and highlighting engaging conversations with insiders and outsiders fighting to create a more just LA. From frontline organizers to community activists, join us as we tackle some of the most challenging social justice issues of the day with heart and honesty. Now get ready for some frank conversations and real talk on Conversations from the Frontlines. For our first episode of season two, I was joined by New York Times bestselling author and national political thought leader Steve Phillips. The episode was recorded live at SoCal Grantmakers 2023 policy conference, titled Reimagine Multiracial Democracy. SoCal Grantmakers, where I co-chair the board, is a network of philanthropists and grantmakers working to shift power and resources toward frontline communities. Listen in as Steve and I get into race, politics, and the future of multiracial democracy. For people who may have critiques of wokeness, it sort of belies this concern that maybe we're focusing too much on race, you know, or maybe we're centering race too much. Why are we still talking about it? Or why is it important to frame things in that way? And actually, I was thinking about the Tennessee example is a good one where mainstream media has certainly picked up on the racism there and, you know, many of the problems, but I haven't really heard it put in the historical perspective of the Confederacy. So just want to ask you to elaborate on why is it so important to understand the current threats in the context of this unfinished battle for the Confederacy that continues on today? How does that change what we do today to understand that historical context?
So I would say maybe two or three things on that. So this phrase, choice between democracy and whiteness, so that comes from Taylor Branch, who wrote the Parting the Waters civil rights book. So he was in, and it's recounted in Isabel Wilkerson's book, Caste. And they were talking about the rise in white domestic terrorism. And particularly rise of white domestic terrorism in 2017, 2018. And so there were all these alarms that had been raised about the Central American caravan right before the midterm elections, a way to try to inject fear, get people to turn out in that election. And the Tree of Life synagogue mass shooting happened on the Friday of that week when they started that caravan drumbeat on that Sunday and Monday. And he specifically said before he got his guesses, I'm going in. I'm not going to let you, just going to stand by. And so there was very much fear of the country being taken over. And so this fear, and this is why I say is truly an existential battle around, is this going to be primarily a country for whites where others may be tolerated, or is it going to be a multiracial democracy? And so that fanning the flames of white people about the changing composition of the country, I would argue, is the primary driving feature and factor in our civic life and certainly in our political life. And so in 2015, so we forget now, we've lived through the past 7, 8 years, that originally Donald Trump was seen as more of a joke, in that, and Obama made fun of him at the dinner they had. He was polling at 4% in the polls in May of 2015. June of 2015, he announces his candidacy and says that Mexicans are rapists and murderers, gets all of this backlash, stands up against that, sends a very strong signal that he will be the champion of fearful white people. And he went from 4% of the polls to 27% of the polls and never looked back. And I would argue, if you look at what's happening on the Republican side with Ron DeSantis trying to get to the side of him. So it's not fundamentally a question in terms of people of color. It's people that question that white, there are a lot of white people and a lot of fear and resentment that is fanned and fomented in the country that drives whites to oppose anything that has to do with multiracial democracy. So that's why we have to get at this issue, because it informs everything. It was the fundamental basis of the opposition to universal health care. Is that, and you know, even David Axelrod says this, people thought this was a giveaway to poor black people. And so if we want to have public policy that addresses the needs of the entire society, we have to be far more both intentional and unapologetic about we want to address racism and we want to create a multiracial society where everybody can benefit and flourish.
Next, I sat down with longtime social justice advocate and community leader, California Assemblymember Isaac Bryan. He shared his reflections on the justice system, the future of reparations in the state of California, and the challenges of the social justice ecosystem in Los Angeles. In this special two-part episode titled Grassroots versus Grass Tops in LA Racial Coalition Politics, Assemblymember Bryan tells Liberty Hill what it takes to build and wield power in the fight for racial justice. So, I mean, gosh, I could talk with you for hours about how you grew up. It's so fascinating and incredible. But you've talked about seeing all these systemic failures up close. You've talked about being raised in a multiracial family, being adopted, going through all these struggles during high school. How do you think all of that impacts you now in terms of the work that you do as an assembly member, as an activist, as a leader?
Yeah, I think I see the barriers more clearly than many others that are in elected office. Because one of the things that I found out when I won my first election was that the pathway to elected office is not actually having experienced any of those things most often. It's proximity to others who are elected office, right? Or proximity to affluence and social capital and political capital, the kind of things that I didn't even know about as a child. And so I think that that empowers me in a different way to fight for the things that I think are important, and to work at expanding opportunity from a place of having that opportunity stifled for myself in many occasions, but in addition for people that I love and grew up around.
And so what did make you decide to run for office? I mean, that's a pretty crazy thing to do.
It is a crazy thing to do. So I was in City Hall for a period of time, and I got frustrated with the limitations on local government. I was in community kind of organizing, and I got frustrated with the limitations of grassroots movements outside of kind of an ecosystem that allowed those movements to translate to power and pressure on elected decision making. And I kind of just came to this conclusion that you really need three things to make a difference with policy. You need courageous elected officials, you need a concerned and organized community, and you need good data and research. So I went back to the university to help kind of build up the data and the research side of that, because I thought we potentially had more infrastructure in those other two areas. And we found some success. We stopped the construction of a new women's jail. In addition to a lot of folks on the ground and folks directly impacted, helped to think differently about youth incarceration, to think differently about policing in our school settings. And then at the end of the day, you know, I had this all figured out, I thought, except I realized no matter what, I had to go knock on the door of an elected official and ask, plead, demand, or beg them to do the right thing. And so when the opportunity to run for office came up in my neighborhood, a neighborhood that has adopted me and embraced me, a neighborhood that I've lived in longer than anywhere my entire life because we had moved so much during my childhood, the community kind of pushed me to run. And I answered that push, and we ran as hard as we could.
Tell us what have been the best parts of being an assembly member so far, and what have been the hardest parts?
The best part, there's no feeling better as an elected official than to stand kind of in the People's Forum, which for the state assembly is the green carpet, right, in Sacramento. If you are on the green carpet, that's where we pass laws. It's where we vote to move things out of our chamber. To stand in that space and to raise your microphone and to speak about the things that matter and see your colleagues changing the way that they think about an issue because of your presence and your voice and your advocacy, that's a feeling that is hard to explain. It's exciting. It gives me personal hope in what can happen. And I'm hopeful that it gives my district and others who watch the Capitol closely a bit of hope when they see me and other colleagues kind of doing that kind of work. So that's the best part, is being able to make changes that you know wouldn't have occurred if you weren't there. The most frustrating part is not being able to make all the changes that you want to.
For part two of Grassroots versus Grass Tops, Derek Steele joined the podcast. Derek is executive director of the Inglewood-based Social Justice Learning Institute, which fights inequities by improving the health, education, and well-being of youth and communities of color. In this episode, Derek shares his inside-outside strategies as a community leader and the challenges and opportunities that social justice advocates face when navigating our political systems in the fight for liberation. The other thing, you know, when you talked about liberation, you know, that's a big word that we don't want to just say casually. You know, I'm curious, what do you envision when you think of liberation? Part of the reason I ask is I think like you said, we've gotten better and better at understanding the world as it is, you know, understanding the how things work and the harmful impacts of the current systems we have. And we know that in order to build something better, we need to envision that. But, you know, it's challenging to envision a society and a way of relating to each other that we've never experienced. And I think liberation, certainly, you know, we may have moments of an experience of liberation, but certainly a, you know, this country is, as you said, founded in white supremacy, has been building fences to prevent liberation for our entire history. So we'd just love to hear what, you know, what does it mean to live a liberated life?
I'll use the analogy that you just said about building a fence. The people who live inside the fence are living very free, whole, thriving, healthy lives, right? And when you think about it that way, it's not something that's foreign, right? It's not something that is non-existent and hard to imagine because it already exists. The question is, how do we eliminate the fences? How do we eliminate the barriers so that all of us have the ability to live life in that fullness? If you're looking at it from that framework, well, what was done to be able to create this space of liberation that already exists? Agitation, right? Be honest, like the folks who live in Santa Monica don't have a lot of the things that they have just by happenstance. If you ever gone to a city council meeting in Santa Monica or a school board meeting in Santa Monica, you can see that the agitators are there to make sure that the things that they want to have in place are there. And they understand the structures. They understand how it works. They understand the pieces that have been put in place and what stuff needs to be undone so that those things and the thriving space that they have in that community can continue to be that. Again, this is not a foreign idea. We just have to make sure that the historic structures that have been put in place, look at it from a housing standpoint, understanding covenants and what role they play and how that had a big deal to be with redlining and how that came to bear. How to undo those things. Those are the fences. Those are the barriers that exist that we don't see, that we don't talk about, that we don't normally hear, that we have to undo to be able to broaden the scope for liberation and access for all people to be able to live thriving lives. If you talk about oil fields, even, you know what I mean? Like, what were the rules that were put in place for people to have that type of ownership of not just land, but also mineral rights and air rights, right? What are air rights and mineral rights all together in the first place? And who came up with those rules? What do we need to do in order to broaden, eliminate the fences around that so that people can all have access to these things too, right? So this is what I mean when I say about the rules of the game. You can't change it without knowing how it's being played. These are the things I'm talking about. But I also say this, Shane, from the way that nonprofit organization exists in our relationship with philanthropy, as well as a relationship with the government, like, you also have to know the rules that govern your entity as well and what capabilities you have based on the entity you have too. You'll have a lot of folks who will start a nonprofit organization because they have a great idea of how to serve people, without really getting the deep dive and understanding of what it means to have a 501c3 organization. And like, even the rules that came to bear to be able to have that type of tax status and how that can be beneficial to your community beyond just the idea you have. So those are the things that we have to come to the table, be on the same page about, be able to come to a way of working together rather than working in silos to be able to uplift our communities, to be able to eliminate the barriers that I was talking about to live whole, free, thriving lives for all those people that we serve.
In episode 4, I sat down with two brilliant organizers and change makers, Hugo Soto Martinez, Los Angeles City Council member, and Jared Rivera, former political director of Service Employees International Union 2015. We explored the theme of co-governance and the importance of building solidarity with community, politics, and labor in LA. We're very interested at Liberty Hill in this kind of inside-outside game. And of course, Liberty Hill Foundation funds all the outside groups, putting pressure on folks on the inside. But we have lots of allies like you, Hugo, clearly on the inside. Jared, I think we could make a case that you're an insider and an outsider. But I'm curious, what is your sort of philosophy on how to strategically do this inside-outside game in your current role, which in your case, Hugo, I imagine it's a big shift. So I'm curious also kind of how your ideas about how to play that game have evolved. And I know you've talked a lot about co-governance and sharing power with the folks that you're accountable to. So I'm curious how that sort of inside outside philosophy, how are you engaging with folks on the outside? And to Jared's point about the key votes that really matter, you've had some no votes that you knew you were in the minority and you did it anyway. So curious also about kind of how you're making those decisions.
Yeah, this has been sort of the most interesting part. We're a little bit of uncharted territory because this is the first time in my memory that we have at least Eunices and I who have been kind of dyed in the wool organizers sort of in there. So this might change over time, but something that James Lawson would talk about a lot, right? He's played like a key role in the union and the civil, I mean, civil rights movement, and even here in the labor movement, would always say is like, everyone has to play their role. I know my role has changed. When I was a leader in Unite Here Local 11, like I played a role in trying to make the union more intersectional, to engage in like fighting the sheriff, supporting Gascon, right? Very similar to some of the things that Jared has done in his union. And now like I got to talk to the most conservative council members in council. Like I got to try to find common ground. At the end of the day, we can wish for all these amazing things, but I'm talking like a politician now. You got to count to eight. We need eight votes, right? And like I learned that very quickly. It's like you need eight votes. Recently joined on with Tim McCosker. He's very pro-labor, but used to be a lobbyist with LAPPL. But we both agreed that police officers get off too easily. They don't face accountability. They don't get fired. The whole process is just incredibly incorrect. But at the same time, I don't want to lose my roots with the people on the ground. And so good case in point is the tenant protections, right? Like, you know, without revealing too much, right? We're like, can we get one of the three? Like that was the discussion at first. And I was like, oh, hell no. Nah. Like, we got to build some pressure. Like, let's get a letter campaign going. Let's do a press conference. Let's mobilize people. Let's door knock. Let's put pressure on the swing votes. And so having that insight from the inside and being able to point and say, hey, you know, y'all are doing the work out there. These are the folks you need to go to, and giving them guidance and clarity. And so they know as much as possible, like what's going on the inside informs the outside strategy, right? And so we were able to offer that, and I think in a very clear way that I think helped us, you know, win some of the best tenant protections in a generation.
Ugo, can you tell our listeners who may not know who the beloved and revered James Lawson is?
He's truly a national treasure. Led the Memphis sit-ins. He segregated that city. Was one of the key folks guiding along Martin Luther King and Gandhian nonviolent direct action tactics. And a lot of people don't know, but James Lawson moved to Los Angeles and eventually helped create the foundation of the labor movement for Mai Garcia and Marilena Durazo in two different unions, and one at SEIU and one at Unite Here, or HGRE at the time. And so a lot of that belief is very much present in the labor movement in Los Angeles.
We at Liberty Hill had the honor and privilege of working with him to launch his National Leadership Institute, which we incubated at Liberty Hill, and it was such a joy to be in his presence. Jared, what about you?
As I think about the inside-outside strategy, I mean, I guess there's kind of two things that come to mind. So number one is just counting votes. Ugo talked about that. Can you get to seven? Can you get to 41 in the assembly? Can you get to all the different votes that you need? And so sometimes we're doing work with folks just to get them elected because they're going to be that 38th, 39th, 40th vote. But then I think also, at least for me, I spent a lot of time talking to candidates to try to make guesses about who are going to be those elected officials who are going to shift the needle, who are more than a vote, but somebody who is going to really change the narrative on an issue. And those are folks we want to make investments in early and really try to bring them in as allies so that we can have somebody inside that we can think about and strategize with and dream with. And so there's a healthy amount of tension there, because I think for us, where it plays out a lot is backing incumbents or not backing incumbents. And when do you make those decisions? Every incumbent is going to be, for the most part, good with you on some issues, but not on those really tough ones that we talked about. I get a lot of people approaching me in my position that want to take on an incumbent. I always call it like the AOC effect, right? They're going to shake up, completely change the landscape. They have a movement on the ground. And people don't remember the fact that, well, 90% of incumbents are going to go through, right? People remember these opportunities where someone did it, but they don't remember all the other ones. Those are risks that are we have to weigh, right? And so when Ugo was running, it was the same thing. And we had a conversation, and and he was going up against an incumbent, and we honestly were not there in the primary with him because we weren't sure yet if this was going to shake out. But then our membership to, you know, move with him in the general, because we could see with him that he was somebody who was going to do the work. He was going to campaign hard and do all the things that people don't like doing when they're campaigning, raising money, putting a real field program together, all that stuff. But we thought he's going to win, or we think he's got a good chance of win, and he's going to change the narrative. And so those are those things that we think about a lot too, or about what are those risks that you take, because you go up against an incumbent and you lose and you're shut out on your primary issues, you know? So it's not something that we take lightly, but I think kind of the anchor of a good inside outside strategy are those handful of just warriors, the Maria Elena Durazos, the Isaac Bryans, the Ugos, these folks that are there that are going to strategize with you and think with you about how to get things done.
Episode 5, let us hear from Los Angeles City Council member Eunices Hernandez and Yvette Ale-Ferlito, Executive Director of La Defensa. Yvette and Eunices spoke with us about the difference between strategic compromise and values compromise, and the importance of an inside-outside strategy in organizing and building coalitions around radical visions. I wanted to ask you, Councilmember, you've talked before about compromise, and obviously you have these very strongly held principles, as you just described, and yet you have to be pragmatic to some degree, and are and have always been in the work that you've done. But I'm curious if you could share a little bit about how you view compromise. I think you've talked before about sort of strategic compromises versus values compromises. Can you share kind of how you think about that concept of compromise?
Yes. And it's a barometer that I'm still building up, because for different things, it's different processes. But I can honestly say more money to the carceral system is one I think I've made clear to all levels of my colleagues that it's not one that I'm willing to really move on. But there are compromises and different discussions that we've had around how we not leave people behind. How can we bring in as many people as possible? And so when it comes to figuring that conversation, that's I'm solutions oriented. So like, don't tell me no, like, let's figure out how we can do this. We have access to decision-making. How can we work together to do it? And for me, what I've learned is that we have to do the labor of whipping votes. Like, we have to have those conversations. We have to educate our colleagues. And sometimes folks think, well, you know, that person, look at their background. They're not going to vote for this. You would be surprised if you look at some of the motions that have come up and who has partnered on motions. That has happened because we have built relationships with folks. So there hasn't had to be, I think, a lot of compromise. That's why I have my barometer all the way there yet. I'm still figuring it out. But when it comes time for really tough decisions, that's when I check in with the base. Like, I have collaborative phone calls again to like make sure that I'm grounded in making the right decision, or if this is a compromise that we need to make. It's always good to go back to a group of people, both who are doing this work day in and day out, who have been impacted by these issues, because I never have worked alone. It's always been with people. And when we said we ran during our campaign, we always said that City Hall would be to open it up for the people. And that part of that is also bringing in community to help you make decisions on certain things.
Hmm. Yeah. So let's talk more about that. So one of the themes we like to explore on this podcast, the inside-outside game. And so I'd love to hear from both of you. What does that mean to you? How do you sort of use inside-outside strategies? And also, I would love to know if your views or tactics have changed as a result of now one of you being on the inside.
Relational organizing has been a fundamental piece of why we've been so successful. Like, having genuine relationships, connecting with people on a deeper level than just this motion we want to get passed. When you really understand what motivates people, what their stake is, because we all have a personal stake in this work, whether you think that you are not someone that's impacted by the carceral system and have loads of privilege, economic privilege, class privilege, racial privilege. The fact of the matter is these systems are impacting all of us. And so when you're able to really understand what someone's personal stake is, then you're able to do the work of moving them in the right direction. I think about some of the county officials who I first approached 7 years ago around our work for alternatives to incarceration, pretrial release, and how adamant they were, that they were not abolitionists, that they were not fully aligned with us, and that they couldn't possibly advocate to their bosses for anything. It was our job to do the advocacy on the outside. And over the years, building those relationships with folks on the inside, you saw a transformation. I witnessed the transformation of folks on the inside stepping out and challenging the sheriff's department at public meetings, advocating for the things that we were advocating for that previously they wouldn't touch it because they were so scared of the politics within the county. And so being able to build those relationships, identify someone's stake, encourage them, provide context and touch points, and then demonstrate that there is support for them on the outside has made all the difference. And so part of my abolitionist values is to see the humanity in everyone, even the folks that may seem like they're not aligned with us, that might be scared, that might be hesitant, that might even push for policies that we don't agree with. Being able to center myself in their humanity allows me to make the changes and shifts incrementally to the point where they become staunch advocates, informants, allies, co-conspirators. And so for me, that's the approach. In terms of having one of us on the inside, it's such a blessing to have someone like Unisys that is values aligned in office. She's well aware. I know you're well aware, girl, that if there are things that we don't agree with, we will let her know. The difference with having one of us on the inside is that there is that channel of communication. There is that relationship where she can come to us when she's struggling with something. We can help inform the tactics and what the potential drawbacks are of a certain decision or what the long game is, because I can only imagine that when you are having to contend on the inside day in and day out, you may lose focus on the bigger picture. So we're there to help support and remind her of the bigger picture and to not just let her know when she's fucking up or when she's doing great, but also be there to do that co-governance. And that's something that I really appreciate about Unisys from day one. She is here for that co-governance model. And on the campaign trail, she always said, we're doing this together. This is not me running. This is us running. And it's that approach that's rooted in our community values and our abolitionist values, that this is collective change that we're doing together, I hope can help alleviate some of the pressure for folks like Unisys that are coming up and can often feel alone, that we are committed to doing this together with her. And so for me, the inside outside strategy is just a continuation of our values and the way that we approach organizing holistically.
In episode 6, Lifting the Curtain on Power and Governance, I explored a new way of approaching governance. We got to speak with Ground Game LA Executive Director Bill Przlucki and LA City Council Member Nithya Raman, and we discussed how local organizers are turning an exciting current progressive activism into electoral power to make lasting change in Los Angeles. We've talked a lot about this concept of co-governance, certainly in the social justice world, with all of these amazing organizers and progressives now elected to city council and the mayor's office. The idea of co-governance has become a hot topic. And Bill, you're one of the sort of lead practitioners and kind of thought leaders on the concept. And I've gotten to hear Bill talk a lot about it, but I'm excited today to get to hear Nithya as well. But would love to hear both of you kind of share, you know, what is this co-governance experiment that you're doing together? And what can we learn from it for collaboratively working on the inside and the outside to make change together in LA?
For me, I made a promise to people when I was running for office that when I knocked on their door for that election, that that wouldn't be the last time that they were hearing from me, and that they would continue to hear from me once I was in office, and that there would be continued opportunities to engage on the issues and talk about policies with us. And I think that we have really tried to deliver on that as much as possible. It's very tough. The districts are so enormous, 260,000 people, you know? So it's like, how do you make sure that people who want to have a seat at the table, who care about these issues, have what they need? We really do our best just from the basics of answering every phone call and taking every person who calls in seriously and listening to them, to thinking about policies in partnership with organizations that are working with impacted communities. So it's never that we are designing a policy on our own and introducing it. It's that we go back and forth with organizations that have the expertise on those issues, who are either themselves made up of people who are experiencing the challenges that we're trying to address through that new policy, or who are serving people who are dealing with those issues. And we work with them to craft policies and to make sure that what we're putting together really works to meet the needs of that moment. I think it also looks like just making sure people have an opportunity to engage with the office on an ongoing basis. It means showing up to community meetings. It means answering questions, even when they're not from people that you may agree with. I think it means really just trying to be out there and engaging with people in a really robust way, with energy, with love, and with, I think, a real understanding that the city that we're trying to build probably looks pretty similar, even if we don't agree on the pathways to get there. Like, everybody I know wants homelessness to be gone. Everyone I know wants an end to homelessness in Los Angeles. The question is, how do we get there? Do we get there by putting people who are experiencing homelessness in jail, or do we get there by housing people effectively and keeping them in their housing? Do we get there by addressing the needs of vulnerable tenants and making sure that they're staying housed? Everyone wants lower housing costs, you know, but they don't want to kind of deal with that kind of change in their neighborhoods when you have a lot of new housing coming in, even though we do need new housing. We desperately need new housing. How can you make sure that you're building supply and you're protecting your existing residents? Like, we can do all that, but we have to do a lot of work to understand how the city can do that. And I think that's, to me, what this process is about, is really just being in conversation with our constituents, being in conversation with the city's residents, and really being willing to engage in that process, because it's long, it can be painful, it can be hard, but it's worth it ultimately to come up with an outcome that I think is ultimately positive for the city.
I think there's multiple sort of axes that we're operating around, because there is the sort of left-right axis sometimes, right? Progressive, conservative, whatever. But there's also this other one about style. And I think that, you know, whether it's coming from, you know, as far left as you can imagine, or way to the right, or anywhere in the middle, I think there's inherently a problem, especially at the local level, with a politician whose sort of posture is like, you go home, don't worry about it, I'm going to solve that, right? And so the fundamental thing that really represents this shift, I think, and what we're really talking about when we're talking about co-governance, is tapping into that, you know, LA's greatest resource, and so often untapped at City Hall, which is its own people, right? Like, LA is just full of awesome, creative, and, you know, this city is so diverse and so eclectic that you can basically find what you need by tapping into the human resource of the people of LA. And so, you know, it is, I think, in one sense, radical to have a politician who's like, well, let me walk you through the steps and actually explain this to you, and not just sort of react to whatever you're throwing at me right this moment. But at the same time, that's fundamental to the shift we're trying to win. And I think that's an inherently progressive way to approach governance. But it's also, just stylistically, it's this totally different and maybe sort of radical way that people all across the political spectrum are having to adjust to, because they're not used to it. Folks are not used to seeing it. So, you know, it's not unheard of that we have times when, you know, folks who are more on our side will be yelling at us on social media about why hasn't something happened right away or big enough or whatever. But I think the invitation stands for anyone who wants to take it, that it's like, the real thing that we can do here is bring you into this process. Like, there really is an open door here where we can walk you through.
In our final episode of the season, we brought together three of the biggest environmental justice champions in LA: Michelle Pritchard, Ashley Hernandez, and Nayeli Cobo. We went deep on the past, present, and future of the environmental justice movement in LA. Michelle, Ashley, and Nayeli shared their hopes for the next generation of environmental justice organizers and advocates as they continue to fight today's climate crisis. Ashley, you mentioned passing the baton, so let's shift gears to talk a little bit about that. I'd like to start with your reflections, Michelle, on how is the movement work and particularly the organizers and activists of, you know, Ashley and Nayeli's generation, how does that look and feel different than what it looked and felt like when you were coming up in the work?
Yeah. Both Nayeli and Ashley kind of alluded to it before, which is, I think what comes with experience and age is trying to figure out that balance between patience and persistence and the urgency of now. You know, young people see the injustice, they see the oppression, and it's like, we have to change this right now, you know. And my older years, I'm feeling the same way too, but we work in a system of laws and regulations. And so, you know, we do have to kind of follow the rules, at least to start on these different campaigns. So I think that's one area where, you know, we've had to kind of do some bridging work, you know, in Stand LA and in other coalitions. I know, you know, Ashley, the community members of Wilmington are like, really? I mean, and maybe this is being inside versus outside in political change, but why do we have to go to another committee meeting and say the same things that we've said for the last 20 times? Well, it's because now it's gone a different track and it's going to a different committee. And oh my goodness, it's just unending. So trying to balance when we need to be patient and play by the rules and keep pushing ahead versus something else, which is having some more disruptive activities. So I think learning history is really important. As we get older, we have experience, we learn more about the world, people, places, effective and ineffective organizing. For the most part, I have felt that young people are very hungry to learn about that. To the extent possible, I think it's our responsibility as an older generation to provide that. Our Liberty Hill grantees are trying to bridge that gap, but it's just a lot along with all the other work. But looking back at past successes and heartbreaks and figuring out what we can learn from them, I think is a joint multi-generational project.
It's so funny. I think when I entered this work, I was 18, 17. And I remember when folks would come up to us or to me and some of the members and be like, wow, what you all are doing is just so incredible. It's so wonderful and inspiring. And I remember just thinking, okay, like, I'm just out, you know, like I did not understand it like at all. It was actually one of the weirdest things that I felt like at the time. I was just like, wow, that is so interesting, you know, and we're just kind of talking about like what's going on, you know, like what's the big deal. And I always tell our members, like, it's such a big deal. Like, what you are doing is such a big deal. And I remember telling my sisters and my family a lot of the time, because I've been doing this work for a cool minute, and telling folks, I think we're just like creating our cool little monsters that are just kind of going to go around and like believe their convictions and go out and do what they want and like organize, you know? And I think it's true, you know, it's true. Like, we just celebrated our 25th anniversary with Youth for Environmental Justice, and this is the longest running program with Communities for a Better Environment. And it began from youth doing a leadership training where they learned what environmental justice was. They had the opportunity to delve into a space that allowed them to be the leaders, and it created a transformative opportunity for many generations, including myself, to benefit off of. And I think one of the things that we've continued to do is embolden and give folks the courage to do this work. I think that is what has given a group like Youth for Environmental Justice the generational success that it has had. And it continues to happen. You know, like, here we are. A lot of our organizers right now are starting new and fresh after a pandemic. And we're dealing with a whole new set of youth of generation. You know, I think this is Generation X. I forget. I know I'm a millennial. I forget the younger generation. I just know that.
I think they're Z.
There's some
Gen Z.
They're Z, Generation Z. Sorry about that. Sorry, Gen Zers. Don't hate me if you're out here. I love y'all. Gen Z, you know, they're a completely different entity, you know. Like, I think millennials, like, we definitely felt that we had to carve a lot of space, right? Because I think, as it was mentioned, right, there wasn't a lot of those spaces. It wasn't so uniform to have BIPOC, right? To have specific conversations and language and dynamics in specific spaces in some of the earlier environmental or like climate spaces. And I think that that's really what the environmental justice movement allowed, right? Is what was for people like me to be a part of. And I think a lot of the folks that were organizing that were likely not even millennials were carving that space for us millennials to come in and, you know, take the baton, right, for the next one, right? And I think it's been really important and really a collective effort to make sure that now folks are coming in with a completely new set of language, right? Like self-care. Like when I came into this space, you know, I wasn't talking about it in that same context, that were a little bit older than me, a little bit more seasoned in this work, that were teaching me, right? Like all of these different phrases, all of this new lingo, this entire new world was shared with me. It allows a lot of us to feel absolutely connected and a part of a bigger thing. And I think that's what our generation has been doing, is really like chipping away at that individualism and being like, no, we're collective now. We're collectively doing this, right? Collectively, we get our freedom. Collectively, we get our liberation. And I think that is why a lot of folks, especially like younger folks, I see how fiery they get, like with injustices. They're like, no, it has to be like equal. It has to be equitable. Like everyone needs to be represented. And, you know, I think that is because of the two generations, millennials and the folks before us, that were really like, right, shaping and carving out that space where it's just like, yeah, like here we are now in a completely new venue. And I'm excited for these folks to use their clever means to contribute, you know, like these fools are gonna be competing with AI to speak. And so it's just the monsters that we have in the next couple of years, the work is only gonna become richer with the folks that are younger coming in, sharing their expertise, honing their expertise, and recognizing that they have an immensity of wisdom to contribute to these movements and these spaces. And I think that's probably one of the most interesting things that I enjoy seeing from this work, is just seeing the tenacity and how every generation is just as like ballsy as the last. And it's true what one of our organizers, Rosemary, says, like, this is heart work, right? Like it's all rooted in like the heart of people. And I think all of the folks that are like connected to this kind of work, connected to movement building, deeply invested in learning and growing, I think we are, and I wish, had we been multiplied in many ways, we would totally be responsible for some greater and faster liberations for all of us. So it's definitely been a treat.
Hmm. One thing that is really true across generations that both Ashley and Nayeli have referenced is that building of community. It's building those bonds with other people, other activists, neighbors. And that's what gives you sustenance for the long haul. What is at the root of that? It's the love that Nayeli referenced early on with her community that kept her going.
Yeah, I don't even know what there's left to say. That was just such a beautiful thing that adding on. Yeah, People Not Fossils was built as an intergenerational grassroots coalition. It was a 9-year-old, my mom, and a few other community members, primarily moms as well. And it was also showed woman power, but that's a side note. But it was seeing how, regardless of our age, regardless of our education background, our language, we showed up because, as simple as my 9-year-old mind could put it, it simply wasn't fair. You know, it wasn't fair that there were these wells in our community that were next to schools, that were where people had to work without protective gear, where we had to breathe these emissions, where so many injustices, and it just wasn't fair. And similar to what Ashley mentioned early on, was adults would always come up to us at the young age and be like, oh, this is so inspiring that you're doing this, or this is so cool. Or something I often was told too is, you should be in school. What are you doing here? And my answer always was, you're right, I should be in school, but I don't have a guaranteed future due to adults like yourself. So I have to be here. And they would be like, oh, yeah, I think you're next to speak. It was just this thing where it's, why do I look like I value less because I'm a 9-year-old in a school girl uniform? Why do I know less because I'm a high schooler? When in all honesty, we know just as much, if not more, because we live in that community. We know that community like the palm of our hand, inside and out. We know the injustices. And just like Ashley mentioned, which is extremely important, we know the solutions. What we need are the tools. We need the uplifting. We need the platform. We need the time to implement these solutions within our communities.
Thanks to all of our listeners for joining us for today's special Best Of episode. Don't miss new episodes of Conversations from the Frontlines coming this spring. In the meantime, you can revisit all of season 1 and 2 episodes here or on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share your favorite episodes with your friends. We'll see you soon for more conversations from the front lines.